first news conference, and I spent most of the morning running between the press office and the East Room, checking the setup for the news conference, and everything went pretty well as far as the preliminaries were concerned. I had very few problems, except that it took the electricians an awful long time to get the lights set up, and we didn't really get them in place until it was about 1:30 before things were ready to go. We brought the press over. It was a tremendous crush of press people trying to get in, and we had supposed to take the camera crews and the sound people over first. We had to cut off at the door of the White House the number of reporters who tried to get in at the same time. Had kept them out for 20 minutes in the very humid air and very hot air, because we felt it wasn't fair for them to try to get in with the camera crews, which it wasn't. And there was a tremendous jam of people at the press conference. When we finally did let the correspondents in, every seat was taken. There was standing room. A good many members of the staff, including Dr. Kissinger and Al Haig and Bob Hartman and Jack Marsh and other high-ranking people, also were in. But the news conference went extremely well. The president sounded to me just a little nervous at the start. He said later he was nervous, and he did sound nervous. I didn't think it started off well. He had a little limp joke that about having to persuade his wife to postpone the press conference that she'd had scheduled for today, and which in return for which he had to make his own breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the next week. But after that, he did well. First question was on what he would do about President Nixon, and he answered, in essence, that he was sympathetic to the idea that the President Nixon had suffered enough, but that the legal actions had to take their course, and in due time, he would exercise his prerogative as president to either grant a pardon or do whatever he felt was right, and so he was going to say no more until the legal process had been completed, because until then he basically had no part in it and would take no part in it, which was a good answer. And from then on, his voice had that ring of presidential authority, which I've noticed amazingly in his most of his public statements. Very good press conference. Everybody seemed pleased with the setup, over which I had many misgivings. The press, especially the White House press covering it, seemed impressed and wrote favorably about it all the way, so we're going to continue that. I wrote a little memo to Terhorst about a few minor technical problems involved, but basically the format seems very good, and I think we'll continue it. During the day, they said that I should go to Columbus to prepare for the Friday speech, Friday morning speech the president will give to the Ohio State University graduating class. And so I finally left on the 8:55 flight that night after working right on through. The 8:55 flight, of course, was delayed, and we didn't get in to Columbus until after 11 o'clock, and I didn't get to the motel until midnight, and immediately went to bed. Got up the next morning and met Eric Rosenberger, the advance press guy, who said we had problems with lights. He wanted to get a CBS crew in. I would have preferred to have had the White House communications people set up lights. They're very well equipped to do it, but he wanted to bring in CBS because he said the university officials were the ones who were protesting the lights, and he felt it would be better if the university officials didn't get the idea that the White House was trying to run things and instead let the university officials fight it out with the networks. So, excuse me. So on during Thursday, we spent most of the day out at the arena walking back and forth, checking out things, but basically waiting for the CBS crew from Chicago to arrive with their lights. The CBS crew came in at 2 o'clock, but their lights didn't. And something had happened to the plane that the lights were supposed to come in on. The crew came in from one direction and the lights from another. And as it turned out, the lights never did come in until midnight. And when they came in, there weren't enough of the right kind. And so on the Thursday passed in a welter of physical effort as far as walking and standing and sitting was concerned, but very little accomplished. It was a very frustrating day, and I got the feeling that this was going to be a bad situation as far as the president was concerned. The problem was that the university officials wanted the film crews to be at least 80 feet from the platform, which meant they had to use long lenses, which also meant they had to have a lot of light. At the same time, the university's TV station, educational station, was doing a live TV pickup, and the university people said they could use the existing light, which was the light normally in the field house for basketball games and such. The TV people admitted this was below right on the line between minimum and bad lighting. And they would have preferred more light, but they were afraid that the light that the TV film people brought in would overshadow the floor lighting and cause them camera problems. So everything was in a mess, and the whole day was spent simply mulling around with no decisions, the type of day that is very frustrating to me. And we didn't get to bed until after midnight, and nothing really decided, and so I didn't sleep well. Had to get up to be at the auditorium at 6 o'clock in the morning, so I had to get up at 5, and I had 4 or 5 hours of sleep, and was not in the best of shape mentally when I did get to the auditorium on Friday, to find that the CBS crew had set up their lights all on one side of the auditorium, which was fine for the film crews. They were getting a nice picture from the side, but the TV cameras, which were in different positions, were getting a picture of a face half in light and half in shadow. Very bad. So finally, we scrounged around for other lights. Couldn't find any on that short notice. Finally got two small lights set up on the other side, which halfway counterbalanced the effect of the power of lights on the other side, but it didn't really do the job. And on film, the president looked great. On videotape, he didn't look as good because the left side of his face was in shadow when he turned the left. The effect was not professional, as we say. It was acceptable, but not really that good. However, the president made an excellent speech, and the audience was with him all the way, and the event went off far better than anyone expected it to, especially me, in the light of the conditions we had to deal with. So it was basically a good day. I flew back on the press plane, which left an hour after the president did. We had a nice steak lunch going back, and didn't get in until about 3 o'clock, but I spent the rest of the afternoon working on the film the president has to do next week to kick off the United Fund campaign. Each year the president traditionally does a 5-minute film appearance in which he inaugurates the campaign for the United Funds, and it's on all networks. And I basically rewrote the script that the United Fund people had provided, and we hope to film that in the White House after his work is finished on Tuesday, so I'll probably be late getting home Tuesday. But I was really ready for bed, and luckily we didn't have to work too late on Friday. There was some talk that the President and the First Lady might go to Baltimore for a Bob Hope show, but luckily that was squelched, and the president went to the residence early and said that he was going to have a short day on Saturday. So since it was the Labor Day weekend coming up, we decided to make it a one-man day each day, with me working Saturday and Eric Rosenberger on Sunday, and Larry speaks on Monday. That way each of us would get 2 days off. So we ended up that way, and I went home rather early, about 7:30 or so, and got to bed in good shape. Saturday was one of the nicer days. I didn't get to work until 8 o'clock, and the first thing on the schedule was a presidential meeting with Attorney General Saxby and Secretary of Defense Schlesinger, in which he got the recommendations for the conditional amnesty program which the president wants to establish. The meeting was supposed to last 45 minutes. It actually went for 2 hours, and there was a lot of give and take and a lot of discussion, according to Jerry Terhorst, who came out afterwards and said that really, literally, everything was discussed, but no decisions were made, and that there would be a decision by the president within a week, and that there would be some sort of an amnesty program, conditional, which would allow those who wanted to return to return and earn their way back through some work, probably for the government of some kind. We'll know more about that later. The rest of the day was really quite smooth. The president was supposed to take off for the golf course about noon and did leave about 12:30, and I stayed in the office until about 3:30 or 4, and did some work which needed to be done, and asked Jerry if I could get off early because I needed to get the car inspected, and that was the earliest I'd gotten away from the office, and then with 2 days off coming up, it was really quite an enjoyable prospect. I got the car inspected and got home in time to have an early dinner, which with the Wrigleys, which is the first entertaining we've done in the house, I think, since Helen got back, and it was really kind of a nice evening after all that work at the office. The week left me, though, really mentally exhausted, drained, I guess you'd say, from the amount of questions and the persistent questions that I got from some people. I can understand now why people get impatient with those who continually pester one with questions on the same subject over and over again, because this is basically what it was, and I was really quite drained mentally when I got home. So I'm looking forward to a weekend which I hope will recharge my mental batteries, as they say, and get me back into a shape where I'm looking forward to getting to work again. And we'll see what happens from now on. Well, I played a round of golf on Monday, got called off the course, slept on Sunday, played a round of golf on Monday, got called off the course with basically an inconsequential phone call, and then went to work on Tuesday for a week that looked to be fairly interesting, because on Tuesday I was in charge and starting to make plans for the first big pre-summit meeting, which was to be held in the East Room, and it was a long, involved process. On Tuesday we spent a good deal of the morning discussing the plans for it, finally worked out the basic plans, and went over them with the public NPAC, the Public Broadcasting Television, which wants to televise it live, and will do the production, except that when we informed the networks that NPAC was going to do it, the network said, well, we will pool it, and NPAC can take the off-the-air feed. The networks would then make the necessary videotape on their own, and then put on what they wanted to at the end of the day. It's a very complicated procedure, and we spent a long time on Tuesday deciding on what the physical layout would be. That was our big problem. We have almost 50 people to be seated, and they're all economists, and they're all important people, in one degree or another, and the problem is to make sure that no one thinks he's outranked by the other. So we finally settled on a huge rectangular table, which will occupy a big share of the east room, and we'll simply have seats all around it and three TV cameras. And it opens tomorrow morning, and we hope that everything goes well. The NBC crew that will handle it will begin setting up in the afternoon, and we had a long argument with Bill Seidman, who did not want any lights in there or any cameras, and we finally convinced him that live coverage was right, and so we're all set to go. Another long day tomorrow, because I've got to get in there before 7 o'clock. And they actually started setting up this afternoon, but had really got the table in position, and then we're going to cover it with a blue cloth and see how it looks tomorrow, and we'll see how it goes. Wednesday, September 4th. This has been quite a euphoric day for me, since I was basically the guy in charge of making the TV arrangements for televising this conference of economists, which was opened by the president, who then spent about an hour listening to the opening part of it. He left and then came back for the closing, and all in all, it was really a brilliant day, and a most interesting day in a lot of ways. First of all, the TV pictures simply looked magnificent. The table, which Rex Scouten had covered with a blue cloth, was so impressive with the chandeliers and everything else in the East Room, it made a picture that was just absolutely perfect. The only thing that marred the whole thing was that at the opening there was some problem with the president's microphone. The network guy apparently didn't know which mic the president had, and there was great confusion. Bad sound as far as the president's first two or three minutes of speaking were concerned, but it really wasn't that noticeable unless you were listening for it. I was in the room when it started and had thought it sounded funny to me, but on the PA system it sounded worse on the replay, but it really wasn't that bad. You could clearly hear what he said. It just sounded hollow because of the fact that he was being picked up by other mics. So outside of that, everything went well. The president was most impressive in his opening remarks, and more impressive in his closing remarks when he was summing up the conference and thanking the people for participating. He had some head-to-head confrontations with a lot of the Democratic economists, Walter Heller and others. And Heller, and this was at the end of the day when they were summing up, and it was widely used, said the president had introduced Heller by saying that he was from a state which had given Michigan great problems in football, and it was rather unusual for a Michigander to introduce a Minnesota man, but that he felt that it was very appropriate, and they had a big laugh about the Little Brown Jug, which is a traditional football rivalry between Minnesota and Michigan, and the fact that Minnesota now has the Little Brown Jug because they've beaten Michigan the last couple of years. And Heller remarked what a pleasure it was to get back to a White House where there was not only a little laughter and a little humor and friendliness, but also a willingness to face up to tough issues and listen to differing views, which obviously he and other Democrats had. It was very, left you with a nice warm feeling about the way the whole thing was handled. Everybody was very happy with the way it went and the way it looked on TV, and I heard nothing but compliments, and so that naturally made me feel good. It was a very great day as far as I was concerned. It was a lost day, too, however, in as much as I spent the whole day at the conference and had no time for anything else in the press office, but it really was a good day. Well, they lost a day in there somewhere. The meeting actually was on September 5th, Thursday, and all that I said before applied to Thursday, September 5th. What happened to Wednesday, September 4th, except in planning for the meeting coming up on the 5th, I don't know, but the first conference was on the 5th, and everything that I said about it still applies, but it happened on the 5th instead of on the 4th. And I really can't remember at this time anything about the 4th. Friday, September 6th, was pretty much a quiet day. In office photos, but nothing very, very exciting, and nothing very interesting, and no big, big stories breaking. It looks as though the aftermath of the conference is very good. We're going to use the same procedure for the conference next week, which will also be in the East Room and will involve labor leaders. Everybody's a little worried about that. We had a meeting in the Roosevelt Room to discuss the plans for the one coming up next week, and for the first time learned that President plans to send a message to Congress recommending a lot of cuts and a lot of programs on the same day that the labor conference begins. So naturally there's a recommendation that be held up, which is on the 11th, and also the day that Congress begins. So the legislative people want to get it into Congress right away, and so there's a struggle between them and the economic side as to what's going to happen. Indications are, however, I think that the message will be delayed. This was a fantastic day this Saturday. I've never spent a day quite like it. I was in charge of the press operation when the president went to a crab picnic Saturday afternoon way down in Fairfax County, south of Fairfax. The Alexandria Police Department is putting on a crab feast for their police department and families, and invited the president. He felt he should go because the department had done so much for him in the interim between the time he was, after he became president, while he was living in his Alexandria home, and also when he was vice president, when they provide a lot of expert protection and a lot of escorts, and so he felt he should go down there. So the president not only went down, but brought with him three Russian cosmonauts and three American astronauts who had happened to come into the White House 15 minutes before. There was also the Russian ambassador to the United States, Mr. Dobrynin. And the scene at this picnic, which was out in the middle of nowhere at a place that looked like an abandoned CC camp, which actually was the Northern Virginia Police Academy, but a police academy that looks very run down. And about 300 people there. And in comes the president in the helicopter. I'm there ahead of time, of course, and walk in with the press as he comes in. He comes up the macadamized road from where the helicopters landed and into the crowd, and keeps walking on through the crowd up to the speaker's platform, and they introduce him. He makes a gracious little speech thanking the Alexandria police, and then introduces the cosmonauts and the astronauts. And then somebody presents him with a funny cartoon in which a hippie-looking guy is holding a cracked world in one hand and a sign saying, fix it, in the other. And then they invite the whole party to join in the crab feast. Well, the problem with crabs is you have to crack them apart and then pick out the meat. And it's a very tedious and time-consuming process. And if you don't like crab meat, it's not very interesting. The Russians obviously had never, except for Ambassador Dobrynin, had never done this. The president obviously hadn't done much. he said that in Michigan they don't have crabs, although they have a few crabby people. But he sat down at a long table in front of the speaker stand with the astronauts and the cosmonauts and the Russian ambassador, and they're all sitting there at this table, and they bring in a bushel of crabs, steam crabs, and the president sits there with a little wooden hammer along with the astronauts, teaching them how to crack crabs and eat crabs. And there's a tremendous crowd. Everybody that can get up around the table is ringed all the way around the table. We've got the press guys came in. There were four film photographers and several still photographers, and they're as close as they can get, right up at the table, and they're all shooting these pictures of these people cracking crabs and eating crabs. It's just an unbelievable scene. The President of the United States at this long table out in the middle of nowhere in Fairfax, Virginia, eating cracked crabs with the Russian ambassador and the Russian cosmonauts. This went on for a long time, finally, and drinking beer, I might add. Finally, the police sergeant in charge asked the crowd to move back, and they did move back and gave him a little room, but that still didn't diminish the interest until finally the president decided he had enough, and then started, got up from the table, and for 10 minutes, spent 10 minutes signing autographs of all kinds. And then he decided he had enough of that and said, I want to look at that Model A. There was a 1929 Model A convertible on display. I don't know whether it was some policeman's or whether it had been left there or what, but anyway, he went down to look at the Model A, took the Russian Major General, who is the head of the space program, sat him in the Model A and tried to explain to him through an interpreter that this was the kind of the car that he grew up with, the president. He also put the another cosmonaut in the rumble seat, showing him the rumble seat with a pretty girl, and explained how he used to go in the rumble seat with girls himself. And all the time, photographers are crowding around shooting film, and there's other crowds around there too, and it is a scene like which I've never seen before involving the President of the United States. And then he finally decides he had enough, heads back to the helicopter, and we all get in the helicopters, and the two helicopters, and go back to the White House. On the way, the president decides to give them a tour of Washington and takes them up the river, past the White House, up the river, over the Key Bridge, back down, right over the Pentagon, showing them the Washington area, and into the White House again, where we all got out. I've never seen anything like it. And then at the conclusion of this remarkable day was the word that we're all going to have, I was supposed to get tomorrow off, but we're all going to have to work tomorrow. There's going to be an important announcement. The president is going to pardon Richard Nixon. I've got to set up the one film camera in the Oval Office. That'll be my job. I'll have to get to work at 6 o'clock in the morning and start on that, and also take the president, or escort the president to church, going to 8 o'clock church across the street at St. John's. And through the remarkable thing is that through all this afternoon, all this long session with the astronauts and the crowd, in which the president was very relaxed and obviously having a good time, in all this time, he did all this knowing that he'd made this decision to pardon Nixon, a decision that will certainly cause strong repercussions, coming as it did. I don't understand the timing myself. I think it's a mistake to do it now, but obviously there must be some reason why he decided to do it now, but we'll know more about that tomorrow. But it really impresses me that he was able to be as natural and as down to earth as he was in that whole hour-long affair at Fairfax at the Alexandria Police Association's crab feast today. Never any indication that any worry or any thought had crossed his mind except having fun with the Russians. Very,
Very solid guy.
I'm recording this later, actually. Sunday was a day that I don't think I'll ever forget. Strange day. We all got in early. The whole press office was there early. And the instructions were that the announcement of the pardon was to be made about 10 o'clock from the Oval Office. There'd be one film camera, and of course the audio would be piped into the press room, and anybody could record it. And there'd be a very limited pool of photographers and writers with the one film camera. So, and we were to make no mention of this until 8:30, an hour and a half before, and then at 8:30 we would start calling everybody, and also then to, on an off-the-record basis, alert them to the fact the president would have an announcement. So I took the president to church and got back, and we started the calling. And immediately the reaction of the press. 30, we started calling out, and as I said, the reaction of the press was at first that there was some major international crisis, which we said immediately killed, but refused to speculate on what else it might be. And during all that time, only one person said, "What is it, a pardon for Nixon?" And of course, he wasn't answered. Nobody was answered, but that was the only question I heard that had any indication of being right on target. Just before the president was going to make his announcement, which was we finally scheduled for 10:30, the union's cameraman and pool with one camera, that all network cameras would have to be in there. So the president told her horse that he only wanted one camera, which Terhorst said was the case, and so we said, "Sorry, we're only going to use one camera." And they said, "Well, there may be no camera." And we said, "Well, that's your privilege. If you don't want to pull it, okay." You know, fluff on our side, because we really wanted that on camera, and Terhorst was all ready to cave in and allow the three or four cameras that would have been needed in the room, when suddenly we got word from the union guys that they were going to go along with our plan. So they did. So we set up the Oval Office, and except for the fact there was considerable trouble with the sound system, which delayed everything for 15 minutes, we were ready to go at 10:30, but actually we didn't get the president in there until about 11 o'clock. He read his, came in, didn't say a word, except, "Are you ready?" Read his statement, signed the proclamation of pardon for the President Nixon, and left without saying a word. Looked rather very serious. The whole tone of the statement was serious, solemn. One report called it grim. It wasn't grim, but it was very solemn. And I thought he was very good in the statement. Ed lived in the statement a bit about the president's health, or the former president's health. And in any case, we scheduled, following the announcement, a briefing by Phil Buchan. And we immediately were bombarded with all kinds of questions as to why, at this time, the pardon was given. To which Buchan really had no real answer. The answer was, "Well, it just seemed like a good time." And, so, until those questions are answered, I don't see very much except problems ahead. During the Buchan briefing, or just after it started, really, the president went out to play a round of golf, and Terhorst said, asked me to go out with the pool. And I pointed out that I was supposed to have a day off Sunday, and he said, "Well, you can take Monday off, but we don't have anybody to go with the pool." So Larry Speaks was supposed to, but they wanted him around because he had legal background, and they needed a guy with legal background to handle the questions. So I went out with the pool, and actually, although it was a wasted 4 hours, I was glad I did, or 5 hours, because after the golf game ended, and the president actually must have had two or three drinks, far more than he usually does at the end of a run, he came out, and I said that I'd had I could give him a capsule summary of the reaction as I'd heard it on the radio if he was interested, which he was, and I summed it up for him. Mostly the congressional reaction, which the first congressional reaction was pretty mild. I think they were waiting to see what the public reaction would be. But on the way out to the car, he said, Bill, do you know that Jerry Terhorst is thinking of resigning? And I said, no. Why? And he said, well, he has very strong moral principles and feels this was not right, and he's thinking of resigning, and I wish you'd talk to him and see if you can convince him to stay because we need him. And I said, yes, sir, he's very valuable. And we do need him. He is very valuable. And I still could not understand why Terhorst would be thinking of resigning on something like this. So I called the press office earlier and suggested that instead of going back to the White House, I simply go on home, where Helen was waiting for me at a Wrigley cocktail party. It was 7 o'clock before I got home, and we were supposed to be there at 5:30. I got to the cocktail party, naturally, almost 2 hours late. Most of the guests had left, so I had a couple of drinks, and then Helen said we had to get back because the roast was in the oven and would be overcooked, which it was. So we got back. Just as I got back in the house, phone rang. The White House calling Terhorst had resigned. So I asked Tom DeCare, who called, whether I should come back. He said, no, I think we can handle it. And I said, okay. You sure? Okay. I hung up, and I couldn't stand it. I said I had to get down there, and I left without dinner and went down to work, the office, and stayed there until after midnight. And shortly after I got there, Helen Thomas came up and said, we need a statement from the president. And I said, I'll try to get one. And so I called the president, finally got to talk to him, got a statement from him. And he said, I wish that Jerry could appreciate how difficult this decision was for me. I don't think he did. It's a very difficult decision. And he said he regretted very much Terhorst's decision, but that he understood it, and that he thought good people, he could see how good people would disagree with him on this very difficult decision, but he still thinks it's right for the country. And so you can't argue with that. And then he said, well, it's a much bigger ball game, Bill. And I said, yes, sir, but there's a pretty good batter at the plate. And we said goodnight. And I heard later from Kennerly that the president was very appreciative that I did come back. Before I talked to the president, I called Bob Hartman. Had to break in on a conversation he was having with Marsh, Jack Marsh. Well, first of all, I called Hartman, and he railed against Terhorst about the rat, the dirty rat that would do a thing like that. And I said, I agree with you, Bob, but right now I think we ought to have a statement from the president. And he said, okay, you call the president, which is why I called the president. Then when I called Hartman back to check the statement we worked out, Hartman said, and I interrupted a call with Marsh after great problems with the White House operator who didn't want to do it. Hartman said, who named Jack Huchen as acting press secretary? And I said, well, I don't know. And so I got Tom DeCare on the phone and said, how did this acting press secretary thing come up? And Tom said he didn't know. He just thought it was just an assumption. And so I said it seemed to me that that was an assumption anybody would make. I mean, it's obvious that as deputy press secretary, he is acting press secretary. So Hartman went back again. Well, who named him? The point is that nobody named him. So, you know, just a common assumption. So finally I said, Bob, I don't think that's really important, because the fact is that he is acting press secretary. Whether he has that title or not doesn't really make any difference. So we finally then called everybody on the calling list with the presidential statement and went to bed in an atmosphere that was considerably less euphoric than the evening before. The resignation of Terhorst is going to make the impact of the pardon even severer, because Terhorst said that he differed with the president as a matter of conscience. And that's going to hurt. Going to hurt badly. I wish he'd held up that resignation. I understand that he had planned to hold it up, but that Newsweek had broken the story and he'd finally confirmed it. Monday, September 9th, the 1 month anniversary of the president's accession to office, was a very, very rugged day. Terhorst came in for no more than 15 or 20 minutes in the morning, cleaned out his office and left, saw nobody. And Jack Huchen had to have his Jack Huchen had his first baptism of fire, although it wasn't very serious. The president went to Pittsburgh to make a speech in which he didn't mention the pardon, but it did help keep the press away from the press office most of the day. They didn't get back from Pittsburgh until the middle of the afternoon. Those of us who were left in the office, however, had the chore of answering the telephone, which was a considerable chore, and we got our first telephone count, which was very adverse, and the telegram count was very adverse. The telephone calls were running about 2.5 to 1 against the president, and the telegrams were running 5 and 6 to 1. And I fielded a couple of calls from irate citizens, which I really dislike to do. But the situation doesn't seem overly bad, and I think there's enough sympathy with the president so that he will get through this storm eventually, although it's clear the honeymoon and first glorious period has ended, despite the fact that president was out of town a good deal of the day. It was a long day for me. I didn't get back till after 10 o'clock on Monday night, and went in fairly early again on Tuesday, got in at 7:30, because it was our first press briefing day. And so Jack Huchen had his first day under fire, and under the worst possible conditions. And he did very well, starting out with a statement that he planned to continue the open policies and disagreed with Terhorst in resigning. And word is beginning to get around, incidentally, that Terhorst, to my feeling, the real reason that Terhorst resigned is because he wasn't told in advance that this decision was coming. He was told after the fact. And in fact, Phil Buchan steered him off the original story by misleading him and saying that the guy who did the arrangements for the Ford side, an attorney named Benton Becker, who had been seen out in San Clemente talking with the Nixon people, that he was out there simply to discuss a question of the tapes and didn't say anything about a pardon. Well, of course, that was a half-truth, and like the most half-truths, was designed to mislead, which it did. Buchan did very well in the briefing. It was the second time he'd done a briefing. He came in after Jack had finished. Did very well. Explained his misdirecting of Terhorst by saying simply that Terhorst had not asked him whether they'd been out for a pardon, which of course was didn't go over very well with the news people because they know the game as it's played. However, we were really getting a lot of calls, and a good many of the press people are talking about a deal and about the atmosphere of the old Nixon administration because of the secrecy of the announcement and all that sort of thing. And it's not exactly pleasant to have to deal with that type of questions. Tom DeFrank says, oh, he's blown it. The election is down the drain in 76. I don't think so. I think that this is going to be a short flurry that may never see the Ford popularity go back to the levels it was last week, but that will nevertheless see him restored in public opinion and justified, I hope, in his decision, although to me the timing still was bad. I feel there must be some compelling reason that caused him to make the decision to grant the pardon. Now, either health or mental problems with Nixon or something else. The Nixon people deny this, but it just seems to me there must be something that changed the president's mind. This is one question, incidentally, that at the news conference on August, his first news conference, he stated he'd let the legal action take its course before he made his decision, and now he's moving to subvert the whole legal action, which of course irritates a lot of people. There's a lot of vindictiveness in some of those questions in the press office, which bothers me very much, and I'm an old Nixon hater from way back, but there's a lot of desire for vengeance visible and audible in the questions as they come from some of the people out there. It's a minority, and a small minority, but it's a disturbing minority. I hate to see that, especially among press people. From the public, it's understandable, but from the press people. So it's been a long, long day, and I hope I get some time off sometime soon, because I'm getting tired. Wednesday was an easy day. Except I had to get up very early and get in to set up the labor meeting, which this is September 11th. CBS did the pool on this. It's very interesting to see the difference between the CBS pool operation and NBC. NBC, the director came in and spent a lot of time there in the afternoon before and on the morning of the conference and did an excellent job. CBS director didn't show up until the morning of the thing. It went on at 9:45. I think he came in at 9 o'clock. And the room was set up by somebody else. The lighting was done. And he didn't have look at it or do anything about it or plan it. I don't quite understand the CBS operation. I have less respect for the CBS production than I do NBC. I really think NBC does a much better job. Interesting to see him work. I still have to do one with ABC. But in any case, the lighting wasn't as good as NBC had it. It was not as hard on the eyes either, I might add, which helped. thought. But again, it was another interesting meeting. The president stayed the whole morning and had some face-to-face confrontations with George Meany, Leonard Woodcock, and some of the other labor leaders. But it was all, even with the pardon hanging in the air, it was all very low-key and friendly sort of a session. The president was hit only a couple of times by labor leaders that were really hitting him hard on issues, and even they were kind of soft when they came to personally talking to him. They were talking about the old administration mostly in their hard-hitting type thing. So there's a lot of respect left for the president. He handled himself beautifully, did not seem perturbed at all or display any visible signs of concern over the situation on the pardon. The phone calls are now evening off, actually running a little favorable. The telegrams and mail count, however, continues to be running about 5-1 against the president's decision, which is... Oh, incidentally, for the first time, we're publicizing numbers, too. On the first day, with their horse gone, they asked me to drop a little mini release on the calls we were getting, so I simply wrote down the numbers, and Tom DeCare, who was with the Nixon administration, said, well, I don't think we ought to put that out. And I said, why not? It's the truth. And he said, well, we just never put out the numbers. So I showed the thing to Hush, and he said, put it out. So we put it out, and I think that's a good thing. So we've had a pretty good day. The president then took off for Pinehurst, where he's going down to dedicate the Hall of Fame and play a few rounds of golf with some of the pros. I would like to have gone on that, but I had this damn labor conference, so I stayed in the office. I went home early. I was the only one in the office who went home early, about 6:30, since there was nothing else to do anyway. And for the first time, had a good night's sleep. Thursday was a very rough day. The press was really snapping at poor old Jack Hushin, who is a little weak in his answers to the press, and the problem is he's just uncertain, and as a result, it's not as positive in defending the president as he might be, but I mean, he's adequate, but not convincing. And the press was really giving him a hard time in the briefing. And the problem was that on Tuesday he'd said, I'm authorized to say that the administration is reconsidering or studying the question of pardons for everybody in the Watergate case. And so this brought a whole raft of questions, and Hushin back to his statement. Well, then, on the following day, another statement was issued saying that, in essence, the statement the day before was not accurate, that what the administration was doing was planning to study any request for pardons that might come in from the Watergate people, which is entirely different. And that left Hushin with a problem, and today, instead of trying to or simply admitting, well, I goofed, he was trying to defend what he said and claim that he was quoted out of context, and he got involved in a pointless argument with Newsmen about the fact that he really wasn't quoted out of context, which he wasn't. And so it was a messy situation. I hope he comes out of it all right, but it was a very unpleasant day, and it went on for a great while into the night, and we were getting still all kinds of questions. I took I don't know how many groups of photographers over to film the piles of telegrams, etc. And we're going to have some of those stories, but it looks like it's going to be a longer fight than I thought to overcome this adverse reaction. I really think that statement on Tuesday was bad, and that simply accentuated the negative reaction and will give us problems longer than anything, although this statement today should really help clear things up. At the end of Thursday, I left at 6 o'clock to take a plane to Montreal and speak to the Radio Television News Directors Association convention on Friday. I'm recording this now after returning from that. And it was a fine time for me renewing old acquaintances, but they gave me a pretty hard time, including some of the old acquaintances, and answering questions about the whole situation. And my problem is the same as Hushin's. When you don't really know everything, it's hard, very hard, to make a decent case for the president. All you can say is have faith in him, and that doesn't convince people that don't know him or don't understand what a great guy he really is. And so I probably didn't do the president all that much good, although I think I did soothe some of the wounded feelings of some of the news directors who were upset over the way their local operations had been treated by White House Advance. And one valuable suggestion came out of the meeting in which we were asked to consult or bring in local news people in talks with Advance people and whatever outfit is putting on the event to make sure they get adequate representation at news during the presidential trip and get access equal to anybody else's. I think that's a great idea and we'll so recommend it. So that's one positive thing out of the convention. The president sent a film message which was well received. They tell me there was no projector capable of putting it on when I spoke. I was supposed to introduce the presidential film, but I didn't get to it, but they say it was good. And so it was a pretty good day. By and large, I got back in the late afternoon. It looks as though things are going to calm down now. The Nixon people issued a statement saying the former president has a very a new blood clot in the upper thigh that's giving him great pain, causing leg swelling, and that this could, I think, be the real reason why the president issued the pardon when he did. And so we'll see what happens. One other thing, Frank Pagnotta came up and asked me to talk to one guy about selecting new press secretary, what my recommendations were, which is kind of flattering, even though it's pretty obvious I won't recommend me and nobody else will, but I'm interested that Pagnotta would ask me to say something, so I'm going to make a couple of recommendations. Friedheim and Bob McCloskey from the government, and I don't quite know who I'd recommend from the print media, except somebody like Peter Lissigor, for example, who I doubt they'd pick anybody from the media, though, since they got burned so badly with their horse. And we'll see what happens. I think the president's going to come out of this all right, with the indications that President Nixon has severe physical problems. That will explain a lot of the unanswered questions that the press has been so upset about. And I'm going to bed.